This is The Takeaway. I'm WNYC reporter Matt Katz, in this week from Melissa Harris-Perry. Good to be with you. Christmas is just days away, and I was hoping, naively expecting, a joyful and relaxing holiday season. Of course, it's shaping up to be the complete opposite of that.
It's here now, and it's spreading, and it's going to increase. For unvaccinated, we are looking at a winter of severe illness and death for unvaccinated. For themselves, their families, and the hospitals, they'll soon overwhelm.
At least 39 states and over 75 countries have reported confirmed cases of the Omicron variant. Omicron is increasing rapidly, and we expect it to become the dominant strain in the United States.
It is less important at this point to focus on the absolute number of cases because Omicron is moving so quickly. Again, based on the international experience with Omicron, it is likely to grow rapidly and more rapidly than we have seen with Delta in the past.
Over the past 2 weeks, positive COVID cases have risen around 30% nationwide. COVID hospitalizations and deaths are up around 20%, and infections among vaccinated people are becoming more common due to the Omicron variant. But while much of this news is disconcerting, it's important to keep some facts in perspective. The vaccines still appear to be effective at doing what is most critical, preventing severe illness and death. That's why health officials are urging people in the U.S. to get booster shots to add an additional level of protection. And we still have the tools at our disposal that have been essential throughout the pandemic, masks and physical distancing. Of course, that does not mean this winter is going to be easy, and it doesn't mean our government officials are responding all that well. So let's break down what you need to know to make sense of this current phase in the pandemic. Here to help me do that is Sikhan Akpan, health and science editor for WNYC Gothamist and my colleague in the WNYC newsroom. Great to have you here, Sikhan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going okay. A little nervous, obviously, like all of us, I think. How about you? How troubled are you by the relative sudden surge in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths over the last several days throughout the country?
I'm less worried than people might expect. You know, I've closely followed every twist and turn of this pandemic since the virus emerged. And I would say that I'm probably about like a 7 out of 10 on the panic scale right now.
Okay.
You know, that's even though, you know, New York reported another 22,000 cases on Sunday, which meant that we broke our single day records for a third day in a row. But, you know, these milestones don't necessarily mean that the state and like the pandemic at large in the nation has really reached its worst point yet. What experts are telling us is that COVID seems to be transitioning into its endemic phase, you know, where the coronavirus would continue to still thrive in perpetuity, but vaccinated people would be mostly spared the worst outcomes. We'll be on this roller coaster ride of infection waves every few months or, you know, every winter. And it could be really brutal for unvaccinated people, but for vaccinated people, you know, you might catch COVID, you might develop like a mild to moderate or, you know, a really bad cold, but right. You would largely be spared the worst outcomes.
So you said brutal for unvaccinated people. Does that mean that most of the hospitalizations and deaths resulting from COVID right now are happening among unvaccinated people?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and by really, really wide margins, you know, so like 8 to 10 times the number of cases, hospitalizations that we're seeing right now are in unvaccinated people versus vaccinated people. And a lot of that has to do with Delta spreading as much as it has to do with the Omicron variant spreading, right? So both spread really fast. Everyone is mixing so much, especially for the holidays, but we're all indoors right now. So, you know, unvaccinated people are really standing to face some very serious consequences over the next few weeks.
What about the booster shots? Are they likely to help against the Omicron variant? And then how are health officials going to even convince people to get these boosters if that's the case?
Yeah, they are. So, I mean, I do want to talk about the Delta variant too, because it is the majority of cases right now. So most infections we're seeing right now are Delta, and we know that the boosters can fully stop those infections. So, and with Omicron, early evidence is very promising, you know, that 2 doses of vaccine will protect against severe disease and hospitalization too. But Omicron can invade our immunity namely our antibodies, better than Delta. So we are going to see infections. We are going to see breakthrough infections. So just to give people some numbers, you know, two doses of vaccine used to lower the chances of catching the virus by 80 to 90%. Against Omicron, it's looking like 30%.
Okay.
The same also appears to apply to people who are relying on previous infections, you know, so-called natural immunity. So an Imperial College London analysis of British healthcare workers showed that prior infection used to lower the odds of reinfection by 85%. Now that's down to 19%. Mm. But on the bright side, we are seeing evidence that boosters can restore this protection against, you know, getting the virus against infection. So Moderna just put out some results today showing that the boosters can restore protection against infection. Pfizer has put out something similar. I think there's still an open question about Johnson & Johnson in that single shot, you know, that allows you to be fully vaccinated. Those people, I think, will need to get boosters as soon as they can, because it's really looking like from some independent analyses that that vaccine cannot protect against infection. So everyone needs to go get boosters, essentially.
Are vaccinated people just as contagious as the unvaccinated when it comes to spreading either Delta or Omicron? Like, if I'm at a fully vaccinated party, if everybody there is been vaccinated and boosted, is it still possible that I can pick it up there and spread it elsewhere, even if I don't necessarily feel sick?
Everyone can be contagious, but it really depends on for how long. So with vaccinated people, that window of infectiousness tends to be shorter.
Okay.
So right now, what we're seeing with Omicron is, you know, we're seeing a lot of breakthrough infections. I think what we'll ultimately find is that those vaccinated people, those breakthrough infections are contagious maybe for like 1 to 2 days, you know, very early on. But given that everything is open and that a lot of our policies right now say, hey, if you're vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask indoors, I think that's why we're seeing like a lot of transmission between vaccinated people, because they are contagious for a short window and they are all mixing in these indoor spaces.
How concerned should someone be if they're vaccinated, get their booster shot, then test positive?
I think you should be less concerned. And I think that is going to be tough for people to hear, because we have for so long set infection as like the metric for concern. But truly, when COVID sort of transitions into being an endemic, what we're saying is that you can get infected if you're vaccinated. Maybe you'll experience like some sniffles, maybe you'll experience a bad cough, but you will be fine. So I expect that we're going to hear some recommendations, and I think we're already starting to hear some recommendations that if you're vaccinated, if you're fully vaccinated, you're fully boosted, and you catch the coronavirus, maybe you don't need to rush out to go get a PCR test. That's where we're heading in the next couple of weeks.
It is hard not to be frustrated with government and health officials, and I'm wondering if we could have been better prepared for this moment. Did we jump back into, you know, indoor socializing and acting normal too quickly?
Yeah, I think we definitely relaxed too much. What we've learned with wearing masks, with social distancing, is that, you know, they not only reduce the risk of COVID-19, but also of flu and other respiratory diseases that spread during the winter. Like the flu, for instance, can cause like 50,000 deaths per year. I think in some ways, like it would have just made sense to say like, hey, we know that another COVID surge is coming. We know that flu season gets really bad in the winter. Maybe we'll start masking again indoors. Maybe we'll start social distancing indoors. And then I think on the testing front, it's tough because, you know, the pandemic was improving, right? Levels had sort of dropped off, even though we were expecting a resurgence. I think that testing capacity probably would have been enough to catch a resurgence in Delta. But when you layer on Omicron on top of that, just given how quickly it spreads, that's why we're seeing these struggles with like turnaround time with testing, with these super long lines, with not having enough resources. I mean, we're hearing that labs like just don't even have enough of the reagents or the chemicals that they need to do these tests. Hmm. And that's always going to happen when you have a huge amount of demand for like any supply chain.
But I read there are fewer testing sites in New York City right now than there had been. And, you know, you walk around New York and you see long lines wrapping around city blocks. It seems in retrospect that more could have been done to ensure testing was widespread and affordable for everyone who needed it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's always more that the healthcare system can do. I mean, I think for one, because we don't have a universal healthcare system, and we rely a lot on private healthcare for these things. I mean, private healthcare makes a lot of its decisions around the demand. So I do just kind of wonder if, like, you know, scaling up fast enough with the healthcare system that we have would have been possible. And I'm not trying to give a pass to public officials. I mean, I think, again, we knew that a Delta surge was most likely to happen this winter. Pulling back on testing resources when that's happening, it just seems a little silly for sure.
If you have any advice for listeners as they navigate this next phase of the pandemic on travel or Christmas with grandma, on New Year's Eve parties, any advice on how we're supposed to be making these decisions?
Panic and fear, and I think complacency to some degree, can create amnesia. We know how to prevent coronavirus infections whenever there's a surge. Mask, social distance, good ventilation, right? Mm-hmm. We now have these vaccines on top of that, which really do lower your chances of severe disease by quite a lot. And so it's time for the unvaccinated to get vaccinated. It's time for people who are eligible for boosters to, like, go get those boosters. Like, do not wait. But yeah, no, I mean, it's sort of just like the similar rules that we had last year for the holidays, right? You know, mask indoors when you can, try to spend time outdoors if you can. I think a big one this year is get tested if you can with a rapid test the day of before you, you know, go to see people. And I think, you know, we're hearing from a lot of our health officials is that people should build their plans around the most vulnerable person who's going to be at that gathering. So if you have, you know, an 80, 90 year old grandmother, you know, take extra precautions such as testing, masking, only hanging out with vaccinated people to make sure that that person stays safe during this holiday period.
Sikhan Akpan is the health and science editor for the WNYC Newsroom. Sikhan, thanks so much for explaining all of this to us.
Yeah, of course. Anytime.
I know it's winter time and you might be tuning in while you're wrapped in a scarf or holding a hot cup of coffee for warmth, but it won't be long until we're comfortably outdoors again. We'll be looking for relief from climbing temperatures then, wherever we can find it. I love a summer hike in the woods where the shade is plentiful and the temps are just a bit lower. And without even leaving the city, I'm lucky to have parks near me with plenty of trees for that summer shade as the temperatures become more extreme thanks to climate change. But it turns out that there's more to it than luck in terms of whether you're near trees or not, because urban planners have been disproportionately planting trees in specific areas for decades, according to the nonprofit American Forests. And by planting more trees in one area and fewer in another, we're actually disadvantaging communities. Trees just don't shade us from the heat. The Forest Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture indicates that trees reduce air pollution, improve our health, provide homes for wildlife, and increase the value of our homes. So when we call attention to the disproportionate number of trees in certain areas of the country, we're talking about the necessity of tree equity, the ability for everyone to experience the benefit of trees, regardless of who you are or where you live. Melissa Harris-Perry spoke with Vivek Chandas, professor of climate adaptation at Portland State University.
You know, tree equity, we've heard the term equity in so many different contexts. And when we put trees and equity together, we're not talking about the trees per se. We're talking about the people that benefit from trees. And so the idea that trees are actually distributed in a particular pattern that we've been able to understand over the last couple of decades, that's really where a lot of this idea of tree equity comes from. The fact that trees are highly clustered in specific neighborhoods and cities trees are not found in other parts of cities. And so that really is what we're talking about, is how that distribution of trees occurred in the first place and what we might do to give people a bit more of the benefits that trees provide.
All right, so let's walk through each piece of that. So first, is this exclusively or primarily an urban problem? You said, you know, how they're distributed in cities. Is this not a problem in suburbs or in more rural communities?
No, it's a problem across the country in many respects. We've seen trees really get hit real hard by various heat waves. We've seen trees get scorched. We've seen fires really burn through large tracts of forests. And those are all things that happen outside of cities. And the question of whether we're able to replant those trees, get those trees back, and providing the carbon sequestration, the cooling effects, all of the climate regulation that trees provide is an essential part of being able to really balance out this planetary system. And so it is something that goes well beyond the boundaries of a city into suburbs, into the rural areas, into agricultural areas as well.
Now, maybe this is almost silly or too basic, but I think we sometimes need to be reminded, what exactly are the benefits of trees to people?
Right. You know, I come from a school of thought that really thinks, that really focuses on the fact that humans and trees have co-evolved together. Like, we are part of a landscape that really depends on the oxygen that trees provide. Trees take in a lot of the carbon dioxide that we breathe out. And so just by each breath we take, we have a symbiotic and mutually beneficial relationship with our leafy friends. And so part of what that leads to is, how does that kind of link of oxygen and carbon dioxide lead to other benefits that humans have? And it really comes down to a whole decade plus of studies that have really kind of focused in on the fact that we have physiological benefits. So that's respiratory health from the clean air that trees provide, cardiovascular benefits as a result of that. We have shade that trees provide, as well as transpiration, which cools the environment. We have a lot of mental health benefits that trees provide as well. Communities that are in hospital rooms, for example, that have views of trees are actually healing much faster than those who don't. And so these clinical studies have been conducted not only in laboratory settings, but also in settings out in the field. And they've been corroborated for, again, many decades. And this is something that we are starting to really understand, that we depend on trees and they provide us these valuable, what we call ecosystem services. That's kind of how nature benefits us throughout our day, throughout the year, and throughout our life. And so that's really something that we've got a really good handle on. And there's volumes of ink that have been spilled on describing the myriad ways that trees are benefiting humans.
So talk to me, given that sort of that notion of sort of where trees are, the other piece of what you began with was this idea that they are, in our built environment, whether urban or otherwise, they are not equitably distributed. So where are trees and how did they get there?
So I entered the tree conversation through understanding the distribution of where are the hottest areas in cities, where are the coolest areas in cities, where are the most polluted air pollution hotspots in cities, and where are they not? And what I couldn't help but notice is this real interesting pattern of where there were more trees, it was on average 15, sometimes 20 degrees cooler in that neighborhood. And that is what really, I started scratching my head and asked my colleagues about, you know, why am I seeing this pattern over and over? And it's really interesting that lower income communities, communities of color, those areas that have been disinvested in over decades don't seem to have that kind of cooler temperatures. And it was very obvious when you looked at those neighborhoods that trees were conspicuously missing. And so when we started to dig into this a bit more, we started noticing that there were these patterns of specific policies that had played out over many decades that go back almost 80 to 100 years ago that would segregate communities based on color of their skin, based on income, based on immigrant status. And those communities would be in some neighborhoods back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And there were federal policies such as, for example, often known as redlining policies that would codify the segregation in cities around the country. And what we noticed was this pattern. Those areas that were redlined, meaning they were segregated, those had far fewer trees and they were far hotter than their non-redlined counterparts. And so we were able to tie, arguably one of the first studies to tie this relationship between what was happening almost 100 years ago to what we're experiencing in terms of temperatures today and in terms of the distribution of trees today.
I personally think that's absolutely fascinating. We have there's this sort of social scientific practice, right, of calling areas without things, food deserts or information right. deserts, or you know, all and to find that there's actually this lack of tree canopy, and to be able to map it onto those same inequities, it does suddenly make tree equity make sense as the phrase, right? Even though when you very first see it, it seems as though you're talking about sort of the equitable treatment of an oak tree versus a maple tree.
Right, right, right. That's exactly right. And, you know, if the federal policies from the past are really contributing and have contributed to the distribution of trees, couldn't one simply argue that we need federal policies to right some of those wrongs? And that's really what justice and equity looks like today in terms of questions about Build Back Better and the tree equity agenda that's embedded in that. Couldn't we argue that that is one of the ways in which the federal government can really move in the direction, a very promising direction to, again, right those wrongs that were done in the past?
How does Build Back Better address tree equity?
Right. So part of the challenge that many municipal governments face in terms of addressing this distribution of trees is that for decades, we have paved out areas of cities with big box stores, with industrial facilities, with large freeway projects and highway projects that went in the 1950s and 60s. And those large land-hungry projects went into areas that were by design disinvested over time. And they were land rents were intentionally suppressed. And so when you have that lower cost land, the cost benefit analyses that the local planners would pursue would say, hey, these are the areas to put the freeways, the big box stores, the industrial facilities. And those were often adjacent to these red line neighborhoods. And so what we end up seeing in local municipal urban forestry agendas is an attempt to try to bring trees back into areas that would otherwise not be able to see trees. And tearing up pavement or asphalt is not only a politically challenging agenda item, it's also very labor-intensive, cost-intensive. And so where a lot of municipal governments are really caught flat-footed is, how do we fund urban forestry? How do we actually move trees into places where we can actually see communities that have been historically marginalized benefit from some of this green infrastructure, as it's often called now? And so the federal Build Back Better policies could put some essential resources into local municipalities to start really moving the needle on getting trees more equitably distributed in neighborhoods that have historically not seen a lot of this greenery. And so that federal, those federal resources are at a critical time where we're seeing heat waves, where we're seeing flooding, where we're seeing air pollution at very high levels and really disproportionately affecting lower income and communities of color, marginalized communities in the past. And so this is an essential step for us to really think about, how do we support folks at the local level in doing the right thing?
We so enjoy and appreciate you taking time to talk with us, Vivek Chandas, Professor of Climate Adaptation at Portland State University.
Thanks, Melissa. It was great to be here.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Across the country, we're seeing what appears to be a disturbing trend in our jails. Due to violence, inadequate medical care, suicide, incarcerated people are increasingly vulnerable behind bars. A report from the Texas Observer earlier this year showed that 124 people died last year in Texas jails. This month alone, three inmates died in a Louisville jail. Just last week, a 16th person died in New York City's jails. And recently in New Jersey, a man named Jayshon Boyd was brutally beaten in a lockup for more than 2 minutes straight without any guards intervening. He ended up in a coma. This doesn't look like a problem that's going away. In fact, it might actually be getting worse. According to 2021 data from the Department of Justice, 1,120 people died in local jails across the country in 2018. That's the highest level recorded since they started collecting data 20 years ago. What makes this crisis even worse is that a jail, unlike a prison, is meant for short sentences or for temporary confinement while they await trial. That means that right now, more than 465,000 people are held in jails across the country who haven't been convicted of anything. We wanted to find out more about exactly what is happening in our country's jails. For more on this, I spoke with Nafisa Goldsmith, the chair of New Jersey Prison Justice Watch, and Samantha Malamed, a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I started off by asking Samantha to break down what sort of violence and dangers inmates are facing in Philadelphia's jails.
I mean, ever since the start of the pandemic, the jails have been on various versions of lockdowns, starting with about 45 minutes out of cell per day. And, you know, varying from there, sometimes people are getting 3 hours. But between the lack of out of cell time and the short staffing, the tensions have just been escalating. 5 people since the start of the pandemic have been killed by their cellmates inside the jails. And there have been a number of suicides. All told this year, there have been 15 deaths inside the Philly jails.
What are the reasons behind these deaths?
Some of the deaths are just listed as pending right now, meaning that the cause has not been disclosed. We do know that a number of them are drug overdoses, at least 2 suicides this year, and at least 3 homicides this year. The reality now is that a lot of units are on medical quarantine. Over 1/4 of the jail, the last I heard, was on COVID quarantine. However, even those units that are vaccinated or not on quarantine, people aren't necessarily getting out because there's just not enough staff to let them out. So it's really because of the short staffing that people are not able to come out to take showers. Some people I heard from had not been outdoors, got any fresh air in like a month or several months.
Wow. Nafisa, the deterioration in conditions and the violence, I mean, what Samantha is talking about isn't an anomaly, right? It's something we've been seeing around the country. You're an advocate in New Jersey. So, I mean, I imagine what Samantha just described sounds familiar to what you've seen in your state?
Yes, but there has to be something made clear. This is nothing new. This is not all of a sudden a, major influx in violence in jails. It's just that people are getting it out more efficiently. I was incarcerated in 2000 in a county jail, and I was there for a year. And violence was the same. The difference is that we did not have the technology to be able to get the word out. And when these incidents would occur, the phones and the units would be cut off. So you can't call home. Visits would be stopped. So you can't tell your family members. But now, as we saw, those who did see the horrific footage of the Jayshon Boyd attack, the only reason why the public knew was because of the video that was leaked. And that had to be from someone on the correction side, because it was officers commentating on the actual footage, not the event as it was happening. So it's not that it's new. It's just that we're able to get the word out now. This is common. This is a culture. It is a culture of abuse. It is a culture of violence. And it is a culture of torture. And we're now being able to see it thanks to technology.
Samantha, I want to just take a step back and get some of this terminology right. We're talking about inmates in jails, not prisons. Can you describe who the people are in jails and why they're there and how it's different from state prisons, for example?
You know, the people who are in the jails, and there are about 4,600 people who are incarcerated in the Philadelphia jails. Many of them have not been to trial. They're awaiting trial. They may be in on probation violations. A small number may be serving short sentences, whereas incarcerated people in prisons, are already sentenced to, in Pennsylvania, to terms of at least a year to 2 years in prison or more.
You mentioned earlier that there is a staffing problem in the Philadelphia jails. Can you explain maybe some of the other reasons you've been given for why there's growing violence behind bars?
You know, like, these are people who are often coming in addiction, maybe still with drugs in their system or drugs, on their persons, who are at risk of overdose or withdrawal. Some of the homicides that I saw when I went back and looked at the criminal information, the basis for the arrest for the person who, appeared to be the one who committed the homicide. I mean, it was clear that it was a person in psychotic crisis, someone who had just been committing like random acts of violence, for instance, just beating people on a subway train and then just put in a cell with a nonviolent drug offender or something like that. So, from what I hear from current and former correctional officers, there should be more care with regard to how people are placed in the cells, so that, you're not putting people at risk. The other thing that is coming up is just that units are being left totally unsupervised. And so, people are, I've seen video and published video of people who were attacked and stabbed, and then the other incarcerated people rushed over to clean up the blood before anyone came and saw, so that they wouldn't all be locked in. So, these are some of the things that are going on. And of course, also you see with correctional officers, I mean, some of the officers have been working 16 or 20 hour shifts, and really are at their own psychological breaking points. And, we've seen some incidents where, an incarcerated person sees the opportunity to make a phone call, grabs it, and then, the officer comes over, tells him to hang up, and they end up getting into a physical altercation. In one case, the officer ended up, really badly beating an incarcerated person with his walkie-talkie. So, yeah, I mean, it's just that tensions, I think, are really, really high. And it's really hard even to get mental health treatment for people, because there's no one even to go and escort someone down to, a counselor. So, I mean, it's just a total breakdown from what I understand in like those basic functions of the jail.
Nafisa, how do we make these jails more humane? Is more corrections officers or bringing in the National Guard, are those possible solutions to this?
Well, I think we should also look at the qualifications when it comes to individuals being hired. You have a lot of young people between 18 and 25 years old who end up going to these academies, and they are being put in positions where they are, responsible for the lives of individuals who are twice their age, three times their age. And these young people are frightened, many of them, and a lot of them respond out of fear. I say that there definitely has to be a new way of how we manage lives. And so, I'm not in the business of making prison better. I'm not here for that. What I am here for is the humane treatment of individuals who are incarcerated, seeing to it that they receive the medical treatment, that they get classified the way that they should be. One of those things, and I like that Samantha spoke to it, is the fact of who they're housing and how they're housing them. With Jayshon Boyd, with Essex County, that Essex County beating, this young man, they knew that he had schizophrenia, and they put him in a gang unit. And also, he was from another county. There are county jails closing all over the state, and they're contracting their population to other jails. And so what is common amongst what happened with Jayshon Boyd and the individual who was stabbed to death and killed at Essex is that both of those young men came from Union County Jail. So there's also county beefs. They exist. And we have to have real stakeholders in the community who's a part of the, you know, decision making and also how we look at incarcerating people. It has to be classifying them the way that they should be, making sure they receive the proper treatment while they're there, as well as coming up with more holistic approaches to how we not only manage the individuals being detained or incarcerated, but the people who are stepping into these positions. You have to be thoughtful. I would never want to put my 18-year-old or 21-year-old in a position where they have to break up a jail fight or a prison fight and they're not prepared. That is frightening. I don't know any young person who would have wanted to respond quickly to what we saw with the Jayshon Boyd video. I mean, you have to be properly trained, and it goes beyond just 9 or 13 weeks of training. It does not make you prepared. So we have to look at how, you know, our officers, because it's not like we're angry with the officers. It's the culture that's abusive to not have people properly trained and putting them in spaces where their lives are at stake as well.
The other way to address this is to get more people out of the jails, to reduce the jail population. You know, like that would be one way to address the staffing issue, and that there should be more transparency and accountability when these issues do happen. Because what we've seen is that there have been criminal prosecutions, but it's only when these issues are exposed by the press or by social media.
And getting people out of the jails, that means
reducing the jail population so that the people that you are incarcerating are the people who really, you know, do need to be in jail, and you have the staff that are appropriate in order to make sure that they're kept there safely.
That was Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Samantha Melamed and Nafisa Goldsmith, the chair of New Jersey Prison Justice Watch. According to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, more than 31,500 ICE detainees have tested positive for COVID since February 2020. The agency is currently monitoring 281 cases in detention centers, and so far they report 9 COVID-related deaths. But researchers from the advocacy group Vera Institute of Justice estimate that the true COVID death numbers are 15 times higher. The new documentary, The Facility, depicts the frightening months at the start of the pandemic from the perspective of those held at the Irwin County Detention Center, a privately run ICE facility in Georgia.
Everybody is here under a lot of stress. We see what's happening outside, how fast it's been moving. Once it gets in here, we all be at risk.
Those detained in the cramped facility weren't given enough PPE. Instead, using makeshift masks of socks or plastic cups, they got what news they could from TVs pinned to the concrete walls, but ICE officers provided little information, even false information, as those inside began testing positive.
There is nobody infected in this facility.
Both of the warrants were in a federal court on Thursday, and they declared that they have tested 3 people and 1 came positive.
According to ICE, there ended up being 146 confirmed COVID cases at Irwin. The film shows inadequate COVID protocols compounding the systemic abuses in ICE detention. For detainees at this facility and others throughout the country, civil disobedience, like hunger strikes, were met with punitive solitary confinement. Court backlogs and unending parole processes mean undocumented immigrants in these deportation proceedings feel like they're serving an unending prison sentence. Joining me now is Seth Fried Wessler, who directed the facility, and Nilsen Barahona, an activist who was in the film when he was a detainee at Irwin last year. Seth, Nilsen, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. You know, I've actually covered ICE and ICE detention for many years, and I've spent countless hours on the phone with ICE detainees. What's extraordinary about your film, Seth, is the visuals. You did video calls with these detainees, and those interviews doubled as a sort of secret camera inside the jail. Seth, can you describe the process here and how you came about it?
when the pandemic really began, when it began to turn our whole world upside down in early 2020, I began trying to find ways to report on what was happening inside of ICE detention centers as this pandemic was spreading. I've reported for years on ICE. And I began making calls using this video visitation app, cameras attached to tablets inside of ICE detention centers that streamed video back onto my phone or my computer screen. And I decided I wanted to try to use this tool now as the pandemic was beginning to figure out what was going on inside of these ICE detention centers. And these conversations, they really sort of began to take over my days in the early months of the pandemic. I met people like Nilsson, Andrea Manrique, who's also in the film, and many others inside of the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia in particular. And I began to have these conversations that would sometimes last hours each day. And it struck me as I was reporting stories for magazines and for the web that I was seeing something that was really profound through the video that was streaming onto my computer screen, and that written stories just weren't going to be able to communicate the world that I was seeing through these screens. And so I embarked on this film project, The Facility. These conversations and sometimes just images appearing, video streams appearing out of the facility into my living room where I was sitting, I thought I was getting access to a place that I really had never been able to get access to in that level of detail and that with that level of intimacy.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. So Seth, you're seeing inside the facility. And Nilsson, I guess by talking to Seth, you're getting a little bit of information about what's going out on the outside, especially as coronavirus is starting to take hold in the country. Nilsson, I'm curious, what kind of information were you getting about coronavirus while you were detained?
The only information that we were getting, you know, when we was detained in the Irwin County Detention Center, we were getting it because of the media. Basically, the television had become a window into the world on the outside. And that was the only source of information that we had at the time, other than, you know, talking to our families or friends. And when it comes to the officials that were running that place, they were completely keeping us out of the loop when it comes to information about what was happening or whatever it was required for us to protect ourselves.
There's a moment in the film where an ICE officer comes into the unit while Seth is on the video with you. And Nilsson, you say, call me back later. But Seth is like, no, let's keep this rolling. So then we can hear the ICE officer off camera lie to you guys and say, no one has COVID in the unit. And then he says, you know, I'm just following orders. The muckety mucks are telling me orders and I'm just bringing them home to you. Here's that clip of the ICE officer.
The people responsible are nowhere to be found. They're all sitting at home somewhere, barking orders, telling people like me what to say to you.
The facility is going to continue addressing issues as they arise. What that entails, I have no idea.
Nilsson, this must have been so frustrating. I mean, there's no information here. Can you tell us, was this normal for ICE officers to come in and talk to you like that, like not giving any information and blowing off your concerns?
Yes, it was normal for them to do that. But this officer, I think he faced like a different situation because he was confronted with the truth, something that we didn't have before. We didn't have any type of piece of information that we could use to push them, you know, to tell us the truth. But since we have put a lawsuit in a federal court, basically they were forced to come and make a statement about what was happening inside that place. And that's what I confront this officer with that piece of information. And I think he find himself in a place where he didn't thought he was going to find himself. And the fact that it was so unexpected for him to be on that position, it kind of pushed him, you know, to come clean with the way they were dealing with the whole situation.
Yeah, you forced him to acknowledge that there were actually were COVID deaths happening. Seth, this exchange reminds me about how ICE enforces immigration policies, but in many cases, it actually contracts out the responsibility for jailing the people it's trying to deport. When it comes to ICE detention, Seth, there's a lot of sort of passing of responsibilities, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most ICE detainees are held in facilities that the federal government contracts with, either private prison companies or with counties. And very often ICE says, you know, the management of the operation of detention centers, the day-to-day care of people who the government is holding, you know, that's really the responsibility of the people we've contracted with. And so in that clip that you just played after, later in that exchange, the ICE officer actually says, look, the facility, the warden here who works for a private company called LaSalle Corrections will decide what they're going to do about COVID protections. Again, everybody in that facility, everybody in the Irwin County Detention Center is held because the federal government had decided to hold people. These are people who are in the custody of the federal government, but the responsibility of the day-to-day operations how people's lives are dealt with is being handed off to private companies that have very different interests, very particular interests, their own interests in how and they're detaining people. You know, even to the point in this film, we see that Nielsen and others are placed in isolation cells because they protested conditions that they faced inside of the detention center.
Protested with a hunger strike, right?
That's right.
Okay.
They went on hunger strike or used these video apps to get videos released to protest the conditions of confinement. And LaSalle Corrections, this private company, placed people in solitary confinement based on its own disciplinary protocols, not government disciplinary protocols, but just summarily decided people are going to be placed, Nielsen included, into solitary confinement or into isolation cells, in some cases for weeks on end. You know, these are decisions being made not by government agencies, but by, in this case, a particular private company that runs a set of ICE detention centers around the country.
And detainees are held sometimes for years, and they're just being held while awaiting deportation proceedings in the courts, but sometimes they can get released without warning or explanation. And Nielsen, that's exactly what happened to you. In the film, you had worried about losing your bond with your young son after so much time away. I'm curious, Nielsen, if you've been able to rebuild that relationship now that you've been released and how difficult that's been.
Yeah, I have mentioned this before. My relationship with my son right now is like stronger than ever, you know. We still, of course, it was a year and a month. It was 13 months in total. This is time that we are never going to get back. He was 5 years old at the time when I was detained. And he's 7 now. And I'm so proud of him, you know, because his character is so strong. And he's been able to come out of this situation, you know, stronger when it comes to his character. And I'm proud of him on that area. But what is hard for me to believe is from the very beginning of my case, it was determined that I was not a flight risk. So I could have easily be with my family the whole time. And the problem that, of course, I think it was harder to explain to my son, but he wasn't the only one who was basically run over, you know, with this situation. My wife, she had a hard time, you know, like financially, emotionally, physically. She was drained when I came out of detention because she had to go through so much in order to keep the family rolling. You know, it was something that we were supposed to do as a couple, taking care of every need of the family. And now she had to do it on her own. And she also had that extra care of having her spouse in detention, which is something that hurt me a lot and something that motivated me to become an activist, because it's really hard to believe that your own government could be doing this to you, you know, because this is the decision of the federal government, and their decision was inflicting pain into the society, you know, and this is happening over and over and over again. And this is one of the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing as an activist now, is because separation of families is such a horrible thing.
Nielsen Barahona spent much of 2020 in ICE detention and has since founded an organization called the Icebreakers. He's featured in Seth Fried Wessler's new documentary, The Facility. It's a co-production from Field of Vision and Type Investigations, and it's streaming at fieldofvision.org. Seth is currently a reporter at ProPublica. Thank you both for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for having us.
Well, that's all we have for you today, folks. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. MHP is on a well-deserved break, but she's back with you for Friday's Christmas Eve show, and then later next week as well. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.